The jetdown was even closer now, nosing about like a blind beast sniffing out its prey. Would it occur to them to search this group of trees? Would they land and send out an armed soldier or two to beat through the copse? And if so, what could he do? He was unarmed, and all his quick-twist agility would be useless against the agonizing pain of a neuronic whip. It was not attempting to land. Either they missed the significance of the trees, or... A new thought suddenly hit him. What if this wasn't a pursuit vessel at all? What if it was part of the meteorological testing? Surely meteorologists would want to test the upper reaches of the atmosphere. Was he a fool to hide from it? The sky was getting darker. The clouds were getting thicker, or, much more likely, night was falling. And it was getting colder, and would get colder still. Was he going to stay out here freezing because a perfectly harmless jetdown had made an appearance and had activated a sense of paranoia that he had never felt before? He had a strong impulse to leave the copse and get back to the meteorological station. After all, how would the man Hummon feared so much, Demerzel, know that Selden would at this particular time be upperside and ready to be taken? For a moment that seemed conclusive, and shivering with the cold, he moved out from behind the tree. And then he scurried back as the vessel reappeared even closer than before. He hadn't seen it do anything that would seem to be meteorological. It did nothing that might be considered sampling, measuring, or testing. Would he see such things if they took place? He did not know the precise sort of instruments the jetdown carried, or how they worked. If they were doing meteorological work, he might not be able to tell. Still, could he take the chance of coming into the open? After all, what if Demerzel did know of his presence upperside, simply because an agent of his working in the university knew about it and had reported the matter? Lisung Randa, that cheerful, smiling little Easterner, had suggested he go upperside. He had suggested it quite forcefully, and the subject had not arisen naturally out of the conversation, at least not naturally enough. Was it possible that he was a government agent and had alerted Demerzel somehow? Then there was Legan, who had given him the sweater. The sweater was useful, but why hadn't Legan told him he would need one earlier so he could get his own? Was there something special about the one he was wearing? It was uniformly purple, while all the others indulged in the Trantorian fashion of bright patterns. Anyone looking down from a height would see a moving dull blotch in among others that were bright, and know immediately whom they wanted. And Clausia? She was supposedly upperside to learn meteorology and help the meteorologists. How was it possible that she could come to him, talk to him at ease, and quietly walk him away from the others, and isolate him so that he could easily be picked up? For that matter, what about Doris Van Ebbele? She knew he was going upperside. She did not stop it. She might have gone with him, but she was conveniently busy. It was a conspiracy. Surely, it was a conspiracy. He had convinced himself now, and there was no further thought of getting out from the shelter of the trees. His feet felt like lumps of ice, and stamping them against the ground seemed to do no good. Would the jet down never leave? And even as he thought that, the pitch of the engine's rumble heightened, and the jet down rose into the clouds and faded away. Selden listened eagerly, alert to the smallest sound, making sure it was finally gone. And then, even after he was sure it was gone, he wondered if that was just a device to flush him out of hiding. He remained where he was, while the minutes slowly crawled on, and night continued to fall. And finally, when he felt that the true alternative to taking the chance of coming out in the open was that of freezing into insensibility, he stepped out and moved cautiously beyond the shelter of the trees. It was dusky twilight after all. They couldn't detect him except by a heat seeker, but if so, he would hear the jet down return. He waited just beyond the trees, counting to himself, ready to hide in the copse again at the smallest sound. Though what good that would do him once he was spotted, he couldn't imagine. Selden looked about. If he could find the meteorologists, they would surely have artificial light. But except for that, there would be nothing. He could still just make out his surroundings, but in a matter of a quarter of an hour, half an hour at the outside, he would not. With no lights and a cloudy sky above, it would be dark, completely dark. Desperate at the prospect of being enveloped in total darkness, Selden realized that he would have to find his way back to the crease that had brought him there as quickly as possible and retrace his steps. Folding his arms tightly around himself for warmth, he set off in what he thought was the direction of the crease between the domes. There might, of course, be more than one crease leading away from the copse, but he'd dimly made out some of the sprigs of berries he had seen coming in, which now looked almost black rather than bright red. He could not delay. He had to assume he was right. He moved up the crease as fast as he might, guided by failing sight and by the vegetation underfoot. But he couldn't stay in the crease forever. He had come over what had seemed to him to be the tallest dome in sight, and had found a crease that cut at right angles across his line of approach. By his reckoning, he should now turn right, then sharp left, and that would put him on the path toward the meteorologist's dome. Selden made the left turn, and lifting his head, he could just make out the curve of a dome against the fractionally lighter sky. That had to be it. Or was that only wishful thinking? He had no choice but to assume it wasn't. Keeping his eye on the peak so that he could move in a reasonably straight line, he headed for it as quickly as he could. As he got closer, he could make out the line of dome against sky with less and less certainty as it loomed larger and larger. Soon, if he was correct, he would be going up a gentle slope. And when that slope became level, he would be able to look down the other side and see the lights of the meteorologists. In the inky dark, he could not tell what lay in his path. Wishing there were at least a few stars to shed some light, he wondered if this was how it felt to be blind. He waved his arms before him as if they were antennae. It was growing colder by the minute, and he paused occasionally to blow on his hands and hold them under his armpits. He wished earnestly he could do the same for his feet. By now, he thought, if it started to precipitate, it would be snow, or, worse yet, sleet. On. On. There was nothing else to do. Eventually it seemed to him that he was moving downward. That was either wishful thinking, or he had topped the dome. He stopped. If he had topped the dome, he should be able to see the artificial light of the meteorological station. He would see the lights carried by the meteorologists themselves, sparkling or dancing like fireflies. Selden closed his eyes as though to accustom them to dark, and then try again. But that was a foolish effort. It was no darker with his eyes closed than with them open. And when he opened them, it was no lighter than when he had had them closed. Possibly Lagan and the others were gone, had taken their lights with them, and had turned off any lights on the instruments. Or possibly Selden had climbed the wrong dome. Or he had followed a curved path along the dome so that he was now facing in the wrong direction. Or he had followed the wrong crease and had moved away from the copse in the wrong direction altogether. What should he do? If he was facing the wrong direction, there was a chance that light would be visible right or left. And it wasn't. If he had followed the wrong crease, there was no possible way he could return to the cops and locate a different crease. His only chance lay in the assumption that he was facing the right direction and that the meteorological station was more or less directly ahead of him, but that the meteorologists had gone and had left it in darkness. Move forward, then. The chances of success might be small, but it was the only chance he had. He estimated that it had taken him half an hour to move from the meteorological station to the top of the dome, having gone partway with Clausia, and sauntering with her rather than striding. He was moving at little better than a saunter now in the daunting darkness. Selden continued to slog forward. It would have been nice to know the time, and he had a time band, of course, but in the dark. He stopped. He wore a Trantorian time band, which gave galactic standard time, as all time bands did, and which also gave Trantorian local time. Time bands were usually visible in the dark, phosphorescing so that one could tell time in the quiet dark of a bedchamber. A Heliconian time band certainly would. Why not a Trantorian one? He looked at his time band with reluctant apprehension and touched the contact that would draw upon the power source for light. The time band gleamed feebly and told him the time was 1847. For it to be nighttime already, Selden knew that it must be the winter season. How far past the solstice was it? What was the degree of axial tipping? How long was the year? How far from the equator was he at this moment? There was no hint of an answer to any of these things, but what counted was that the spark of light was visible. He was not blind. Somehow, the feeble glow of his time band gave him renewed hope. His spirits rose. He would move on in the direction he was going. He would move for half an hour. If he encountered nothing, he would move on 5 minutes more. No further, just 5 minutes. If he still encountered nothing, he would stop and think. That, however, would be 35 minutes from now. Till then, he would concentrate only on walking and on willing himself to feel warmer. He wiggled his toes vigorously. He could still feel them. Selden trudged onward, and the half-hour passed. He paused. Then, hesitantly, he moved on for 5 more minutes. Now he had to decide. There was nothing. He might be nowhere, far removed from any opening into the dome. He might, on the other hand, be standing 3 meters to the left, or right, or short of the meteorological station. He might be 2 arms' lengths from the opening into the dome, which would not, however, be open. Now what? Was there any point in shouting? He was enveloped by utter silence, but for the whistling of the wind. If there were birds, beasts, or insects in among the vegetation on the domes, they were not here during this season, or at this time of night, or at this particular place. The wind continued to chill him. Perhaps he should have been shouting all the way. The sound might have carried a good distance in the cold air. But would there have been anyone to hear him? Would they hear him inside the dome? Were there instruments to detect sound or movement from above? Might there not be sentinels just inside? That seemed ridiculous. They would have heard his footsteps, wouldn't they? Still, he called out, "Help! Help! Can someone hear me?" His cry was strangled, half embarrassed. It seemed silly, shouting into vast black nothingness. But then he felt it was even sillier to hesitate in such a situation as this. Panic was welling up in him. He took in a deep, cold breath and screamed for as long as he could. Another breath, and another scream, changing pitch. And another. Selden paused, breathless, turning his head every which way, even though there was nothing to see. He could not even detect an echo. There was nothing left to do but wait for the dawn. But how long was the night at this season of the year, and how cold would it get? He felt a tiny, cold touch sting his face. After a while, another. It was sleeting invisibly in the pitch blackness, and there was no way to find shelter. He thought, it would have been better if that jet down had seen me and picked me up. I would be a prisoner at this moment, perhaps, but I'd be warm and comfortable at least. Or, if Hammond had never interfered, I might have been back in Helicon long ago, under surveillance, but warm and comfortable. Right now, that was all he wanted, to be warm and comfortable. But at the moment, he could only wait. He huddled down, knowing that however long the night, he dared not sleep. He slipped off his shoes and rubbed his icy feet. Quickly, he put his shoes back on. He knew he would have to repeat this, as well as rubbing his hands and ears all night long to keep his circulation flowing. But most important to remember was that he must not let himself fall asleep. That would mean certain death. And, having carefully thought all this out, his eyes closed, and he nodded off to sleep, with the sleet coming down. Rescue. Ligon Jannar. His contributions to meteorology, however, although considerable, pale before what has ever since been known as the Ligon controversy. That his actions helped to place Harry Selden in jeopardy is undisputable, but argument rages, and has always raged, as to whether those actions were the result of unintentional circumstance or part of a deliberate conspiracy. Passions have been raised on both sides, and even the most elaborate studies have come to no definite conclusions. Nevertheless, the suspicions that were raised helped poison Ligon's career and private life in the years that followed. Encyclopedia Galactica. 25. It was not quite the end of daylight when Doris Van Abele sought out Jannar Ligon. He answered her rather anxious greeting with a grunt and a brief nod. "Well," she said a trifle impatiently, "how was he?" Ligon, who was entering data into his computer, said, "How was who?" "My library student, Harry. Dr. Harry Selden. He went up with you. Was he any help to you?" Ligon removed his hands from the keys of his computer and swiveled about. "That Heliconian fellow? He was of no use at all. Showed no interest whatever. He kept looking at the scenery when there was no scenery to look at. A real oddball. Why did you want to send him up?" "It wasn't my idea. He wanted to. I can't understand it. He was very interested. Where is he now?" Ligon shrugged. "How would I know? Somewhere around." "Where did he go after he came down with you? Did he say?" "He didn't come down with us. I told you, he wasn't interested."
"Then when did he come down?"
"I don't know. I wasn't watching him. I had an enormous amount of work to do. There must have been a windstorm and some sort of downpour about 2 days ago, and neither was expected. Nothing our instrument showed offered a good explanation for it, or for the fact that some sunshine we were expecting today didn't appear. Now I'm trying to make sense of it, and you're bothering me."
"You mean you didn't see him go down?"
"Look, he wasn't on my mind. The idiot wasn't correctly dressed, and I could see that inside of half an hour he wasn't going to be able to take the cold. I gave him a sweater, but that wasn't going to help much for his legs and feet. So I left the elevator open for him, and I told him how to use it, and explained that it would take him down and then return automatically. It was all very simple, and I'm sure he did get cold, and he did go down, and the elevator did come back, and then eventually we all went down.
But you don't know exactly when he went down.
No, I don't. I told you, I was busy. He certainly wasn't up there when we left, though, and by that time twilight was coming on, and it looked as though it might sleet. So he had to have gone down.
Did anyone else see him go down?
I don't know. Clausia may have. She was with him for a while. Why don't you ask her?
Doris found Clausia in her quarters, just emerging from a hot shower.
It was cold up there, she said.
Doris said, Were you with Harry Seldon, Upperside? Clausia said, eyebrows lifting,
Yes, for a while. He wanted to wander about and ask questions about the vegetation up there. He's a sharp fellow, Doris. Everything seemed to interest him. So I told him what I could till Lagan called me back. He was in one of his knock-your-head-off tempers. The weather wasn't working, and he...
Doris interrupted.
Then you didn't see Harry go down in the elevator? I didn't see him at all after Lagan called me over. But he has to be down here. He wasn't up there when we left.
But I can't find him anywhere. Clausia looked perturbed.
Really? But he's got to be somewhere down here.
No, he doesn't have to be somewhere down here, said Doris, her anxiety growing. What if he's still up there?
That's impossible. He wasn't. Naturally, we looked about for him before we left. Lagan had shown him how to go down. He wasn't properly dressed, and it was rotten weather. Lagan told him if he got cold, not to wait for us. He was getting cold, I know. So what else could he do but go down?
But no one saw him go down. Did anything go wrong with him up there?
Nothing. Not while I was with him. He was perfectly fine, except that he had to be cold, of course.
Doris, by now quite unsettled, said, Since no one saw him go down, he might still be up there. Shouldn't we go up and look?
Clausia said nervously, I told you, we looked around before we went down. It was still quite light, and he was nowhere in sight.
Let's look anyway.
But I can't take you up there. I'm just an intern, and I don't have the combination for the upper side dome opening. You'll have to ask Dr. Lagan.
26. Doris Venneboli knew that Lagan would not willingly go upper side now. He would have to be forced. First, she checked the library and the dining areas again. Then she called Seldon's room. Finally, she went up there and signaled at the door. When Seldon did not respond, she had the floor manager open it. He wasn't there. She questioned some of those who, over the last few weeks, had come to know him. No one had seen him. Well, then, she would make Lagan take her upper side. By now, though, it was night. He would object strenuously. And how long could she spend arguing if Harry Seldon was trapped up there on a freezing night, with sleet turning to snow? A thought occurred to her, and she rushed to the small university computer, which kept track of the doings of the students, faculty, and service staff. Her fingers flew over the keys, and she soon had what she wanted. There were three of them in another part of the campus. She signed out for a small glide cart to take her over and found the domicile she was looking for. Surely, one of them would be available, or findable. Fortune was with her. The first door at which she signaled was answered by a query light. She punched in her identification number, which included her department affiliation. The door opened, and a plump, middle-aged man stared out at her. He had obviously been washing up before dinner. His dark blonde hair was askew, and he was not wearing any upper garment. He said, "Sorry, you catch me at a disadvantage. What can I do for you, Dr. Venabili?" She said a bit breathlessly, "You're Rogan Banastra, the chief seismologist, aren't you?"
"Yes."
"This is an emergency. I must see the seismological records for Upperside for the last few hours."
Banastra stared at her. "Why? Nothing's happened. I'd know if it had. The seismograph would inform us."
"I'm not talking about a meteoric impact."
"Neither am I. We don't need a seismograph for that. I'm talking about gravel, pinpoint fractures. Nothing today."
"Not that either. Please, take me to the seismograph and read it for me. This is life or death."
"I have a dinner appointment."
"I said life or death, and I mean it."
Banastra said, "I don't see..." But he faded out under Dora's glare. He wiped his face, left quick word on his message relay, and struggled into a shirt. They half ran, under Dora's pitiless urging, to the small, squat seismology building. Dora's, who knew nothing about seismology, said,
"Down? We're going down?"
"Below the inhabited levels, of course. The seismograph has to be fixed to bedrock and be removed from the constant clamor and vibration of the city levels."
"But how can you tell what's happening Upperside from down here?"
"The seismograph is wired to a set of pressure transducers located within the thickness of the dome. The impact of a speck of grit will send the indicator skittering off the screen. We can detect the flattening effect on the dome of a high wind. We can..."
"Yes, yes," said Doris impatiently.
She was not here for a lecture on the virtues and refinements of the instruments.
"Can you detect human footsteps?"
"Human footsteps?" Banastra looked confused. "That's not likely, Upperside."
"Of course it's likely. There were a group of meteorologists Upperside this afternoon."
"Oh, well, footsteps would scarcely be noticeable."
"It would be noticeable if you looked hard enough, and that's what I want you to do."
Banastra might have resented the firm note of command in her voice, but if so, he said nothing. He touched a contact, and the computer screen jumped to life. At the extreme right center, there was a fat spot of light, from which a thin horizontal line stretched to the left limit of the screen. There was a tiny wriggle to it, a random, non-repetitive series of little hiccups, and these moved steadily leftward. It was almost hypnotic in its effect on Doors. Banastra said, "That's as quiet as it can possibly be. Anything you see is the result of changing air pressure above. Raindrops, maybe. The distant whir of machinery. There's nothing up there."
"All right. But what about a few hours ago? Check on the records at 1500 today, for instance. Surely you have some recordings."
Banastra gave the computer its necessary instructions, and for a second or two there was wild chaos on the screen. Then it settled down, and again the horizontal line appeared. "I'll sensitize it to maximum," muttered Banastra. There were now pronounced hiccups, and as they staggered leftward, they changed in pattern markedly.
"What's that?" said Doris. "Tell me."
"Since you say there were people up there, Venabili, I would guess they were footsteps. The shifting of weight, the impact of shoes. I don't know that I would have guessed it if I hadn't known about the people up there. It's what we call a benign vibration, not associated with anything we know to be dangerous."
"Can you tell how many people are present?"
"Certainly not by eye. You see, we're getting a resultant of all the impacts."
"You say, not by eye. Can the resultant be analyzed into its components by the computer?"
"I doubt it. These are minimal effects, and you have to allow for the inevitable noise. The results would be untrustworthy."
"Well then, move the time forward till the footstep indications stop. Can you make it fast forward, so to speak?"
"If I do, the kind of fast forward you're speaking of, then it will all just blur into a straight line with a slight haze above and below. What I can do is move it forward in 15-minute stages and study it quickly before moving on."
"Good. Do that."
Both watched the screen until Banastra said, "There's nothing there now, see?" There was again a line with nothing but tiny, uneven hiccups of noise.
"When did the footsteps stop?"
2 hours ago, a trifle more.
"And when they stopped, were there fewer than there were earlier?"
Banastra looked mildly outraged. "I couldn't tell. I don't think the finest analysis could make a certain decision." Doris pressed her lips together. Then she said,
"Are you testing a transducer, is that what you called it, near the meteorological outlet?"
"Yes. That's where the instruments are, and that's where the meteorologist would have been." Then, unbelievingly, "Do you want me to try others in the vicinity, one at a time?"
"No. Stay on this one. But keep on going forward at 15-minute intervals. One person may have been left behind and may have made his way back to the instruments."
Banastra shook his head and muttered something under his breath. The screen shifted again, and Doris said sharply,
"What's that?"
She was pointing. "I don't know. Noise."
"No, it's periodic. Could it be a single person's footsteps?"
"Sure, but it could be a dozen other things, too."
"It's coming along at about the time of footsteps, isn't it?"
Then, after a while, she said,
"Push it forward a little."
He did, and when the screen settled down, she said,
"Aren't those unevennesses getting bigger?"
"Possibly. We can measure them."
"We don't have to. You can see they're getting bigger. The footsteps are approaching the transducer. Go forward again. See when they stop."
After a while, Banastra said, "They stopped 20 or 25 minutes ago." Then cautiously, "Whatever they are."
"They're footsteps," said Doris with mountain-moving conviction. "There's a man up there, and while you and I have been fooling around here, he's collapsed, and he's going to freeze and die. Now don't say, 'Whatever they are,' just call meteorology and get me Jannar Legan. Life or death, I tell you. Say so."
Banastra, lips quivering, had passed the stage where he could possibly resist anything this strange and passionate woman demanded. It took no more than 3 minutes to get Legan's hologram on the message platform. He had been pulled away from his dinner table. There was a napkin in his hand and a suspicious greasiness under his lower lip. His long face was set in a fearful scowl. "Life or death? What is this? Who are you?"
Then his eye caught Doris, who had moved closer to Banastra, so that her image would be seen on Jannar's screen. He said, "You again. This is simple harassment."
Doris said, "It is not. I have consulted Rogan Banastra, who is chief seismologist at the university. After you and your party had left Upperside, the seismograph shows clear footsteps of one person still there. It's my student Harry Selden, who went up there in your care, and who is now quite certainly lying in a collapsed stupor and may not live long. You will, therefore, take me up there right now with whatever equipment may be necessary. If you do not do so immediately, I shall proceed to university security, to the president himself if necessary. One way or another, I'll get up there, and if anything has happened to Harry because you delay 1 minute, I will see to it that you are hauled in for negligence, incompetence, whatever I can make stick, and will have you lose all status and be thrown out of academic life. And if he's dead, of course, that's manslaughter by negligence. Or worse, since I've now warned you he's dying."
Jannar, furious, turned to Banastra. "Did you detect?" But Doris cut in.
"He told me what he detected, and I've told you. I do not intend to allow you to bulldoze him into confusion. Are you coming now?"
"Has it occurred to you that you may be mistaken?" said Jannar, thin-lipped. "Do you know what I can do to you if this is a mischievous false alarm? Loss of status works both ways."
"Murder doesn't," said Doris. "I'm ready to chance a trial for malicious mischief. Are you ready to chance a trial for murder?"
Jannar reddened, perhaps more at the necessity of giving in than at the threat. "I'll come, but I'll have no mercy on you, young woman, if your student eventually turns out to have been safe within the dome these past 3 hours."
27. The three went up the elevator in an inimical silence. Legan had eaten only part of his dinner and had left his wife at the dining area without adequate explanation. Banastra had eaten no dinner at all and had possibly disappointed some woman companion, also without adequate explanation. Doris Venebile had not eaten either, and she seemed the most tense and unhappy of the three. She carried a thermal blanket and 2 photonic founts. When they reached the entrance to Upperside, Legan, jaw muscles tightening, entered his identification number, and the door opened. A cold wind rushed at them, and Banastra grunted. None of the three was adequately dressed, but the 2 men had no intention of remaining up there long. Doris said tightly,
"It's snowing."
Legan said, "It's wet snow. The temperature's just about at the freezing point. It's not a killing frost."
"It depends on how long one remains in it, doesn't it?" said Doris. "And being soaked in melting snow won't help."
Legan grunted. "Well, where is he?" He stared resentfully out into utter blackness, made even worse by the light from the entrance behind him.
Doris said, "Here, Dr. Banastra, hold this blanket for me. And you, Dr. Legan, close the door behind you without locking it."
"There's no automatic lock on it. Do you think we're foolish?"
"Perhaps not. But you can lock it from the inside and leave anyone outside unable to get into the dome."
"If someone's outside, point him out. Show him to me,"
said Legan. "He could be anywhere."
Doris lifted her arms with a photonic fount circling each wrist. "We can't look everywhere," mumbled Banastra miserably. The founts blazed into light,
spraying in every direction. The snowflakes glittered like a vast mob of fireflies, making it even more difficult to see.
"The footsteps were getting steadily louder," said Doris. "He had to be approaching the transducer. Where would it be located?"
"I haven't any idea," snapped Legan. "That's outside my field and my responsibility."
"Dr. Banastra?"
Banastra's reply was hesitant.
"I don't really know. To tell you the truth, I've never been up here before. It was installed before my time. The computer knows, but we never thought to ask it that. I'm cold, and I don't see what use I am up here."
"You'll have to stay up here for a while," said Doris firmly. "Follow me. I'm going to circle the entrance in an outward spiral."
"We can't see much through the snow," said Legan.
"I know that. If it wasn't snowing, we'd have seen him by now. I'm sure of it. As it is, it may take a few minutes. We can stand that."
She was by no means as confident as her words made it appear. She began to walk, swinging her arms, playing the light over as large a field as she could, straining her eyes for a dark blotch against the snow. And, as it happened, it was Banastra who first said,
"What's that?"
and pointed. Doors overlapped the two founts, making a bright cone of light in the indicated direction. She ran toward it, as did the other two. They had found him, huddled and wet, about 10 meters from the door, 5 from the nearest meteorological device. Doris felt for his heartbeat, but it was not necessary, for responding to her touch, Selden stirred and whimpered.
"Give me the blanket, Dr. Banastra," said Doris in a voice that was faint with relief.
She flapped it open and spread it out in the snow.
"Lift him onto it carefully, and I'll wrap him. Then we'll carry him down."
In the elevator, vapors were rising from the wrapped Selden as the blanket warmed to blood temperature. Doris said,
"Once we have him in his room, Dr. Legan, you get a doctor, a good one, and see that he comes at once. If Dr. Selden gets through this without harm, I won't say anything, but only if he does. Remember..."
"You needn't lecture me," said Legan coldly. "I regret this, and I will do what I can. But my only fault was in allowing this man to come upperside in the first place."
The blanket stirred, and a low, weak voice made itself heard. Banastra started, for Selden's head was cradled in the crook of his elbow. He said,
"He's trying to say something."
Doris said,
"I know. He said, 'What's going on?'"
She couldn't help but laugh, just a little. It seemed such a normal thing to say. 28. The doctor was delighted.
"I've never seen a case of exposure," he explained. "One doesn't get exposed on Trantor."
"That may be," said Doris coldly. "And I'm happy you have the chance to experience this novelty. But does it mean that you do not know how to treat Dr. Selden?"
The doctor, an elderly man with a bald head and a small gray mustache, bristled.